You know what, Fiona? I think we should crack on, don't you?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going for episode one of Underground Overground, a 10-part virtual series, looking at the different lines on the underground and what's above them. Fiona, I'm going to hand over to you.
Splendid. Thank you very much. And I'm going to start in the traditional manner by sharing my screen. There we go. Hopefully now you can see a lovely map of the centre of the underground, because while we're not necessarily in this series talking a lot about the lines themselves or the, you know, the development and the architecture and things like that, we thought it would make sense to start with a quick overview of how the underground network developed so that we all kind of know where we are. And what we're going to do as we go through the series is broadly go chronologically by line. So you'll gradually, those of you who are new joining us this time, you'll gradually meet the other guides during the course of the series. If you've been with us before for the other series, then they'll be very familiar faces. And so this I thought we'd zoom in on the centre of the map just to kind of talk about how it developed to start with. And it is the world's first underground passenger railway. And it started with the Metropolitan Line, which will be broadly the, you know, what I'll be talking about the rest of today, which started originally from Paddington and went along to Farringdon, so a relatively short stretch to start with. It opened in 1863, and by the following year, it already extended down to Hammersmith. But this section here, nowadays we know it as the Hammersmith and City Line, and it was only branded as that much, much later in the 1980s. So although it physically arrived early, it's going to arrive into our series quite late. Followed by, also in the 1860s, 1868, the District, which was an entirely separate company. And the District is the green along the bottom here. And as soon as the District got going, the plan was always to join them up and make the Circle. And that happened by the 1880s. And all of those are shallow, subsurface, cut and cover lines, which I'll come back and explain what that means, if that's an unfamiliar phrase, in a bit. 1890, we get another world first, the world's first deep level electric railway, and it ran down here. It was called the City and South London Railway, but it became the Northern Line. And by about 1920, the rest of the sort of the central section of the Northern Line was in place. And that kick-started a real boom in railway building. So we also get the what's now the Waterloo and City. And again, it existed physically quite early, but only became part of the underground map in the 1990s. So again, it will arrive quite late in our series. And then in 1900, we get the Central Line in red across the middle. And that was had a flat fare of 2p wherever you travelled. And the nickname for the entire network came from the advertising of the Central Line, which was the Tuppenny Tube. And so the tube stuck. Followed by the Bakerloo in brown and the dark blue Piccadilly, both of which opened in 1906. And then we have a big old wait for the Victoria, which was 1969. So the pale blue Victoria, quite a long time after the rest started. And then 10 years on from that, we have the line that was intended to open for the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977, but it was a bit late. So it was 1979. The top half of the Jubilee is opened, partly kind of carved out of the Metropolitan tracks. And eventually in 2000, it extended out to the east and went out to Stratford. And if we'd started this series a month ago, that would have been the end of the story. But no, not anymore. This map I'm showing you at the moment is actually from 2015 because it's a nice uncluttered map. If I just show you, this one is September 2021, and you can see it's getting a bit more busy. We've got the pink and white of the Thames Link, which has been there for a long time, but only recently made it onto the map. We've got TfL, the Crossrail, the Elizabeth Line, as it will be, We've even got a little bit of tram just sneaking into the corner of the page here. But most importantly, if we zoom in, September the 20th, about 3 weeks ago, we got two brand new stations on the Northern Line. The Northern Line droop, as I think I might call it, has arrived. So we have Nine Elms station and we have Battersea Power Station. And that means we now have 272 stations on the network, covering about 402 kilometres. So it has grown significantly, you know, over the years. But like I say, we're not necessarily talking so much about the lines themselves. We're talking about the places you can get to and what you can see from those lines. So this is a geographically accurate version of the tube lines. And again, I'm going to zoom in a bit because it's quite hard to make sense of it when you see the whole lot. So if we look at the top northwest corner, here's the Metropolitan line snaking out into the countryside. And again, this is not just the underground. We've got a bit of National Rail and a few other bits and bobs. And this exciting dotted line down here, which will be Crossrail eventually. In central London, if you walk about 2 minutes away from a tube station, the chances are you're going to be getting closer to another tube station. So in a way, the kind of the spheres of influence, the areas we're going to talk about in central London are going to be quite small. As we go out along the line, then the places you reach are going to get bigger and bigger in a way because the stations are further apart. So we've got a bit more scope. And I'm going to really stretch the definition of what we're dealing with today for our first location. I'm going to take you a 15-minute car drive from Chesham Station. And mostly I've kind of tried to stick things you can get to within walking distance, but I thought this was worth doing because it's quite an important place and possibly even a topical place. So this is Berkhamsted Castle. And you can see nowadays it's ruinous. It's got a few bits of walls. It's got very clearly the motte. It was an absolutely traditional Norman motte and bailey castle. This is what it looked like at the end of the 1100s, not long after Thomas Becket had been resident here and had done quite a lot of building works here. Quite a few names through history have been associated with it, or, you know, big names. But the important thing that happened here, from my point of view, happened even before the castle was built, because in 1066, sometime early December, William the Conqueror met both the Archbishop of York and also Edgar the Aetheling. So Edgar the Aetheling is the great nephew of Edward the Confessor. And after the Battle of Hastings, Harold was killed at the Battle of Hastings, and the Saxon kind of establishment, the Witan, actually voted for another king, and it was Edgar the Aetheling, but he was very young and he wasn't really kind of a great contender to be king. But officially, the last Saxon king of England for a couple of months. The Battle of Hastings started today, the 14th of October. William won the battle, marches up towards London, doesn't manage to breach the defences of London and goes around it. And it's in Berkhamsted, accepts the surrender of Edgar. And I think the fact that they came to a settlement rather than William kind of storming into the city of London, breaching the walls, if you like, is partly why we still have that very two-centred centre of London. So we've got the royals in Westminster, and then we've got the City of London, the kind of the finance, the commerce, the merchants, if you like, inside the walls still. And I think the settlement that William came to kind of strengthened that position. And Berkhamsted was built by William's half-brother as one of a ring of defensive castles around London, about a day's march out from London. One of the other ones stayed in slightly better condition is down here, Windsor Castle. The royals have been living in it ever since. And again, looking at this map, you can see that once Crossrail or the Elizabeth Line, whatever, connects up properly to the underground system of London, then the London's mass transport network will be reaching out past the line of defensive castles as built by William the Conqueror nearly 1,000 years ago. So we're stretching out beyond the boundaries. But we're going to go back to the beginning of the metropolitan line. These are the great and the good, the VIPs of London, the people invited to the opening day, the 9th of January, 1863. And they travelled along the line, took about 3 hours, longer than a normal service, because they got on and off at each station and went, ooh, look at that. And then they had a slap-up banquet in Farringdon Station, or near Farringdon Station. I think that the banquet lasted almost as long as the trip along the line.